in New York. So as a method of transmitting power, no way. You're still going to live with the inverse square law and radio signals. Let me drop it. No matter what frequency the signal is on, a radio signal falls off extremely fast. Most radio signals, you lose more than 1,000,000 to 1 of the signal in the first mile of distance. And at 60 hertz, you're going to get something very similar to that. The only exception to that rule is that if you have extremely high focusing power at the antenna, a laser pointer, because the wavelength is so extremely small, it's nanometers of wavelength, and you've got the many, many nanometers of the equivalent antenna in a laser pointer. Therefore, the beam coming out of a laser pointer is so finely focused, your 5 milliwatt laser 5 feet away may still give you 3 watts of signal, if you know what I mean, because it's extremely focused. Can you now focus a 60 hertz antenna to do that? If the antenna is as big as the Earth, maybe. As you can see, if his intention is to transmit 60 hertz signal, for signaling purposes, yes, you can do it. For power transmission circuits purposes, out of the question, because you can't get enough focusing. I may have answered a question way off to one side of what was asked, so correct me on that one, now, Roy. AC2, Golf of Sierra. Golf Sierra, K2IW, you got it, Roy.
No, Dick, it sounds like a good answer to me. I mean, I answered him that my gut sensibility is the last thing that a energy company would want, would be a resonance circuit being their transmission line. Because, you know, as you keep on saying, first you resonate, then you radiate, the last thing they'd want is to radiate their electrical power off of their transmission line. They want to keep it to the end station. Otherwise, that's kind of what radiation resistance amounts to. It's a radiation loss, which is wonderful if you're running an antenna, but not too good if you're running a utility.
Yeah. Now, what do you believe is the reason he wanted to transmit a 60 hertz signal? Was it in order to transfer power wirelessly from point A to point B? Do you think that's possibly what was in the back of his mind with that question, Roy? Your guess, go ahead.
My guess is that it wasn't a power question. It was just a CW transmission question. Could he somehow finagle the transmission line to act as an enormous antenna for him?
Now, the D-layer absorption in this case is going to kill you. The first novice Morse code contact I made with my first novice license on 37.75 or something like that, 3.75 megahertz, was done at high noon on 80 meters, and the person I could just barely hear, I'm putting 25 watts into my transmitter, he's putting 25 watts into his transmitter, he was the adjacent town. I lived in Farmingdale, he was in Amityville, a couple of miles away from me, and the signal was very weak, a couple of miles away. At high noon, signals below 40 meters, we'll say, 40 meters, 80 meters, 160 meters, you get a huge amount of D-layer absorption. The D-layer of the ionosphere disappears at nighttime, but in the daytime, it absorbs signals like crazy at lower and lower frequencies. That's the main reason why your AM radio station, running many kilowatts of power, only carries, we'll say, 30 miles or so between that broadcasting station and your receiver, your car receiver, maybe 30, 40 miles, numbers like that. Only at nighttime when the D layer, let me drop. Only at nighttime when the D layer disappears do you start hearing DX on the AM broadcast band, and that's the reason why a number of those stations have to go to lower power at nighttime, so they're not interfering with somebody half a country away. So because the D layer absorption gets higher and higher at lower and lower frequencies, by the time you get down to 60 hertz, that's going to be another thing that's going to make it difficult. Even to transmit a microvolt signal, to transmit the Morse code at 60 hertz, I think you're going to have to do it at nighttime. I don't think you can get the signal through in the daytime if the receiver is more than a couple of miles away. That's my experience and guess on that one, D layer is going to kill you. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, K2RIW.
I would agree, Dick. I mean, this isn't even ultra-low frequency transmissions. I don't know how many ultras get tacked on for something like 60 hertz. I mean, as far as I'm aware, the military hasn't gone anywhere near those types of frequencies. It's just a lose-lose proposition. I mean, if you could figure it out, it probably has some strange benefits. But yeah, I agree with you entirely.
WA2VDH with a comment.
VDH, I'm going to pick you up in a second. VA2VDH. Turns out that the government did build a receiver that could listen to 400 hertz. Most military equipment works at 400 hertz. During the Southeast Asia War, they did build fancy receivers listening to 400 hertz so that they could tell when nearby equipment by somebody else was being run. They could listen to the 400 hertz, very weak signal being transmitted, and by listening to the exact frequency of the 400 hertz and the exact waveform, they would recognize the signature and say, oh yeah, that's the guy over the hill. We've measured him once before. We recognize the characteristic of his 400 hertz. So at 400 hertz, they did measure the leakage signal of 400 hertz power supplies. To B2VDH, K2RIW, go ahead.
I just wanted to mention on the subject, I have one of these VLF receivers. It's designed for listening to those atmospheric sounds like surfeits and whistlers and all that stuff. It's really just a bunch of op-amp amplifiers with some active filters in the front. But it does have filters in the front end to block out 60 hertz hum. Because there is quite a bit of, you know, hum pickup from the power lines that are around. It's designed mainly for listening to those surfeit sounds, those dawn chorus type sounds in the atmosphere, whistlers, those descending tones that you hear are generated by distant lightning and that kind of stuff. Go ahead.
This is very similar to what happens when you're listening to the Voyager spacecraft, 12 billion miles away, three times the distance to Pluto, and they're listening on 8.5 gigahertz. But if your receiver is only 100 hertz wide and rejects all the noise at higher and lower frequencies, you can listen to an extremely weak signal. How weak a signal can you listen to is strictly a function of what is the signal-to-noise ratio of your receiver. The signal-to-noise ratio is, the signal is there, maybe super weak, but the noise is all the extraneous noise that Mother Nature is creating at higher and lower frequencies, and you've got to filter that away. So if you can make the filter very narrow and reject all the noise above and below your signal, you'd be amazed how weak a signal you can listen to. So at 400 hertz, for instance, if your receiver is 1 hertz wide and rejects everything more than 400.5 and 399.5, anything outside of that range it rejects, then that signal can be very, very weak with a low noise front end, and you'll pick up that signal. So signal-to-noise ratio is a function of bandwidth of the receiver. Unfortunately, as you go to super weak signals and a very narrow receiver, the rate at which you can send the signal through becomes very slow. If you've got a 400 hertz transmitter transmitting data, and you've made the receiver 1 hertz wide so you can hear a very weak signal, you can only transmit 1 bit per second, if you know what I mean, because the receiver is only 1 hertz wide. So you pay the price, but you can always listen to a more and more weak signal if you make the receiver more and more narrow. Let me drop. Hewlett-Packard made this beautiful device called a dynamic signal analyzer. 3581, I think it's a four-digit number with a 3 and a 5 in it. This dynamic signal analyzer by Hewlett-Packard. You can tune it anywhere from 1 hertz to 100 kilohertz. And you can set the bandwidth. It uses digital signal processing, and you can set the bandwidth a millihertz of bandwidth, a thousandth of a hertz bandwidth. and you can listen to extremely weak signals. I one time used that receiver to listen to the leakage of the local oscillator coming out of my IC2AT transceiver, my handy-talking IC2AT. The actual local oscillator runs at 72 megahertz, and the mixer doubles that to 144. When you're listening to 144 megs, the oscillator is at 72. And you study the schematic, you find that out. I was listening to the 72 hertz signal with that Hewlett-Packard dynamic signal analyzer set to the millihertz bandwidth, and I found out that somebody could pick up my handy-talkie in the receive mode. It wasn't transmitting. It was just receive mode, and I'm listening to the local oscillator. And he could walk to the other end of the building, AIL's building, half a mile away, and I could still hear that local oscillator being the leakage of that local oscillator coming out of that handy-talkie. By way of a telephone on the other end of the building, I told him to turn the IC2AT handy-talkie on and off, and I could hear the signal coming and going in my receiver. And by the way, the receiving antenna was a simple little random length of wire plugged into the center conductor of that dynamic signal analyzer. If the bandwidth of your receiver is exactly on the right frequency, and this was crystal controlled, the handy-talkie, and if it, if the receiver bandwidth is narrow enough, you'll be absolutely amazed how weak a signal you can listen to. I don't know what the signal level was, but if it, someone told me it was 0.001 microvolts, I would believe it. Ain't that crazy, John? WA2VDH, K2LIW.
Oh, yeah, fine business, Vic. Yeah, when you really narrow down the bandwidth, as you say, you exclude a lot of the noise, and it's amazing what you can pick up. But to get back to this very low frequency stuff that Roy was mentioning, this receiver I'm talking about, it wasn't a receiver in the actual sense of a tuned circuit and whatnot. It was really just a bunch of op amps that had active filters in front. I'll give you an example of how it worked. I remember about 20 years ago, before they decommissioned the Omega very low frequency navigation signals, I was out at Montauk on the beach, and I could actually hear as a very high frequency tone in the receiver the Omega signals going on and off at 10.2 kilohertz, I think it was 13.6 kilohertz. You could actually hear that tone of the carrier as audio coming out of this receiver. So it was essentially just a very high gain audio amplifier hooked up to some front end filters. Go ahead.
Fantastic. And what you're describing now is an analog bandpass filter. A digital signal processor can synthesize a 1 millihertz receiver with inductors and capacitors and op amps. You might not be able to do that. When you were listening to that 10 kilohertz signal out at Montauk, the Omega or whatever it was transmitter, how far away was it, and what was your receiving antenna on that system? That's an interesting experiment you did, John. Over to you, John.
Oh, the Omega channels. I know they were decommissioned. I think it was about 15 or 20 years ago they were decommissioned. But let me see. There was one in North Dakota. I think there was one in Australia. There was like I think 8 different Omega transmitters around the globe. I don't know how they were spaced, but I think they were supposedly like maximally distant on there. But the only antenna I had was a short whip antenna, and this receiver, as I said, I actually still have it. It was just like about maybe 4 or 5 very high gain operational amplifiers, and it did have a front end high pass filter to prevent 60 hertz a noise pickup, because otherwise you would get 60 hertz hum pickup from surrounding power lines and stuff. I have heard some of those whistlers, and serpent sounds like during thunderstorms from distant lightning. Oh, go ahead.
Before we had global positioning satellites satellites and transmitters and receivers. Before we had, let me drop. Trying to find out where that, oh, I see where this is coming from. Well, my transmitter was making his wish. That's my, standby with the question. The, before we had that kind of a system, was this Omega system done for worldwide navigation, marine navigation, by picking up multiple signals? And they probably had their own call letters for identification, and maybe a slight difference in frequency, maybe not. And you picked up these various Omega transmitters and measured the phase difference. And was that a way by which a marine person could find out within the nearest mile or so where he was located on the Earth? Was that used for marine navigation, John? W2VDH, K2LIW?
Yes, Dick. Yes, that was, it was a global system, as I understand. And I think there were 8 stations around the world running very high power. And, of course, their antenna systems were huge. If I remember, they were, I think, at 10.2 kilohertz, 12.6, and something like 13.8 kilohertz. There was a 3 or 4 very low frequency channels that they operated on, and they were sequenced. First, the signal at North Dakota would come on, and then the next time slot, it was a signal, I think, in Australia, and then the next time slot. So they were very tightly sequenced in time, and all they did was transmit carrier. There was no modulation. It was just on-off carrier. And the receiver, as I remember, compared the phase of the various different signals, and that's how they got a position. If you Google it, even though the system is phased out, if you Google it, I think you can still find some information on how it worked. I remember there was a company on Long Island that made the receivers for those, made the navigation receivers. I forget what it was, but I know we had some of our students go there to work. Anyway, back to you, Dick.
At first, you were telling me that 10.2 and 13.7 kilohertz, you made it sound like the individual signal stations were on different frequencies. Then you said that they were time-sequenced. Did they do both? I mean, you could make them all on 10.2 kilohertz if you sequence them, and I guess by referencing to National Bureau of Standards time, you could know which sequence during which interval, you know, the first 15 seconds of the minute would be station A, and the next 15 seconds would be station B. So did they identify the stations by the slot of the time sequencing, or were they identifying the signal by the different frequencies they were on, but still they were being sequenced for some crazy reason? So how was that working? How was the real identification? Did a station transmit only one particular frequency, or only one particular time slot, or both one particular frequency and one particular time slot? How was that done, John? W2VDH, K2LIW?
As I remember, Dick, each station had its own time slot, and then they would also transmit on multiple frequencies, but it was very tightly synchronized. I think they were controlled by atomic clocks, it was shared among 3 or 4 different frequencies. So there was a lot of things that they had to do in each of these time slots to retune the antennas, you know, to get them to work at these different frequencies as they shifted frequencies. But there was no modulation on them. There was no form of modulation. It was just carrier on, carrier off. By knowing the sequence, that's how the receiver would lock in and then calculate their position. I think the information of how they worked is still available on the net, but I know that they were phased out. I think it was about 20 years ago they phased out the system. Go ahead.
Now, I've got 2 questions on what you just told me. Let's assume there are 3 or 4 frequencies. Let's make it 4 frequencies. Does each station during its time sequence transmit all four frequencies simultaneously? That's question number one. And then station number two transmits in its time from the slot the exact same four frequencies. Is that what they did? And how long was each time sequence? Did each one transmit for 15 seconds, for instance? You could use four time slots and 15 seconds per time slot. Is that roughly what was done from your recollection, John? WA2VDH, K2RIW?
No, as I remember, each station transmitted one tone, one frequency at a time. But one particular station would at the next time around go to a different frequency. So they had to have the ability to retune or go through a different feeding network to have their antenna resonant. And their antenna was huge. But each transmitter at one time was only transmitting on one frequency. Go ahead.
Okay, it sounds like by way of the sequencing technique, during the first time slot, station number one transmits on 10 kilohertz. During the next time slot, station number one transmits on 12 kilohertz, or something like that. That's what it sounds like. So each station goes through that particular sequence. Do all stations... Now, are they time sequenced so that only one station somewhere in the world is on and the other omega stations are off? Or does each omega station transmit simultaneously on frequency one and simultaneously on frequency two? Or maybe during the first sequence, station one is on the first frequency, station two is on the second frequency during that time sequence, or during its time sequence. So how does the sequencing of frequencies and time work? And when somebody did do a transmission, did he transmit for 15 seconds? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
As I remember, there was only one station on at a time, and the length of the transmission, I remember hearing the carrier for, I guess it was about maybe 3-4 seconds, like a 4-second burst of carrier, then another station would come on possibly at a different frequency. If you give me a second, I'll go run upstairs and get my pad, and I'll Google it and see what I can find. Because I know there's still information out there about how the system worked.
Okay, your system then was tuned to just one of those frequencies. How, and the transmission was for 3 or 4 seconds. How long would you have to wait until that frequency came back again somewhere in the world, or for that frequency to come back again to your favorite omega station, whichever one was the loudest to you? So how long did you have to wait to listen to your favorite frequency if you were tuned to just one frequency? How long did you have to wait for that frequency to come back on the air? Back to you, John.
I remember being on the beach at Montauk, because we used to go out there regularly. I'd say that I would hear this burst of tone that would last, as I said, about 3 or 4 seconds, and then I would have to wait, because I only stayed on one, I could only recognize one tone. To me, it sounded like I was hearing, the sweep frequency of an old TV, the horizontal sweep frequency. It would sound like that. So it would, to me, it would cycle around to that first, the one that was strongest to me. I'd say, about maybe a 15 or 20 second interval. Go ahead.
Very good, John. And you were young enough where your ears worked well at 10 kilohertz. Nowadays, you might not hear 10 kilohertz as well as you did then. Is that true, John?
Yeah, especially in one ear. Actually, from my younger days of riding the subway, especially down to South Ferry, where the train has to make that extremely tight loop around the tip of Manhattan for South Ferry Station. There was a lot of squealing there that knocked out some of my high-frequency hearing. Go ahead.
Yeah, many young people have very good high-frequency hearing when they're young. When I used to repair television sets, and I was 18 years old, I could walk into a house and tell you exactly how many television sets are working and which room they were in. I was hearing the 15.75 kilohertz, the horizontal oscillator for the horizontal sweep to the cathode ray tube. I would hear that tone as I walked into the house, and by turning my head, I could find out which room the television set was on. 15 kilohertz I was listening to is a high-frequency squeal. Not now. I don't think I go beyond 5 or 10 kilohertz these days. Oh, well. I know that Wes wants to ask a question on all this jazz, and we're taking an awful lot. We're deviating on Roy's time, so make it brief, Roy, even though I'm very wordy. I mean, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead.
I found HP Agilent key size 35618. Dynamic signal analyzer from 125 microhertz to 100 kilohertz. Is that the one?
Now that's the one, and that is a magic machine. You can make it down to the millihertz of bandwidth or a much wider bandwidth if you want, and anywhere from a fraction of a hertz all the way up to 100 kilohertz of carrier frequency. That signal, that thing will find a signal that's buried in the noise by 60 dB if you go to a narrow enough bandwidth. So that's a fun machine to use. It's an oldie but a goodie. That's a very well-designed machine by Hewlett Packard. Over to you for any quick comments on that one, Wes.
Can I hear Hume of 60 hertz on it?
Okay. You just told me the lowest frequency it'll go to, and I didn't hear that. I know it goes up to 100 kc on the high end. What's the lowest frequency it's specified at? Go ahead.
125 microhertz.
So you're asking, will it tune to 60 hertz? Obvious by the information you just gave me, the answer is yes. So that will hear a 60 hertz signal. And maybe that's the machine you need for the experiments you've been doing. Because maybe you would rather transmit power at 60 hertz than at 400 hertz. Back to you for a quick one on that one, Wes.
That's exactly what I need. My question is, I don't see in the front panel of it. I know that there were two models. I don't see any input for the headset or the speaker.
There is an audio output. And there's a couple of outputs on the back panel. The front panel only has the input ports and a bunch of knobs, and it's got a cathode ray tube display. And it very slowly gathers the information and displays it continuously on that cathode ray tube. But it's got a number of ports on the back. So if you go to the right website that tells you past information, you can download the owner's manual for the 3561 Hewlett Packard. And therefore, you'll find out how many outputs it has, Wes. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm just looking at it, but it says 223 pages, so I didn't get into it yet. But do thank you very much. I know that John had one. I wasn't fast enough to get it. And to exchange.
Yeah, once I described to John what I was able to do with that machine, he said, I gotta have one of those. And he went out and bought it. Oh, well. Okay, let's go back to Roy. Roy's going to have a nice puzzle he's going to give us. But isn't it amazing that all of this jazz just came from that mailbag article you got, Roy? ACQGS, K2LIW. Sorry to take up your time.
No, it's no problem, Dick. Well, that's the nature of this. I've learned that you can't predict anything. A topic that I thought would take up about 3 minutes could take up an hour and a half, and stuff that I thought might interest people just kind of flounders there. So it's interesting to kind of predict, but my prediction powers are worse than Kreskin used to have.
Okay. Sounds like I didn't get you angry this time. Kind of go ahead. I've been mistreating you. Go ahead with the rest of your presentation, Roy.
Sure. I have a couple of puzzlers tonight. One is relatively easy in that it's a yes-no, so there's only two options. But I hope people participate and think of what the question means. The other one's a little bit more open to interpretation, and hopefully I'll have a chance to talk about some aspects. Well, the first question is it theoretically, is it practically possible to pick up an object that is 300 degrees Fahrenheit? The whole thing is 300 degrees Fahrenheit, not one portion of it. The whole thing is 300 degrees Fahrenheit. Can a human being pick up such an object in their bare hands and hold it?
AXM.
Yes, Rich.
I will hazard a guess that it is possible because firewalkers are able to walk across hot coals, and if you have your hands wet, you create a thin layer of liquid which acts as an insulator. So I will hazard a guess, yes. I won't try it myself. I'll say yes. WBTGXM.
I'm guessing you could only do that for a very brief period. You might be asking continuously. Is that true, Roy?
I'm asking continuously.
Yeah, Rich, I don't think you could do that continuously. Eventually that water would boil, and you got a great big blister. Under one very special condition, I say you can do it, Roy.
Okay, tell me the special condition.
Let's see if anyone else has a guess first before I give up my guess at an answer.
VDH with a comment? John.
I would say yes, and my caveat is that it would depend on the heat capacity of the material. I mean, like that aerogel, that very light, fluffy stuff, if it was heated up to a high temperature, when you picked it up, the amount of heat it would be giving off to you would probably be very little because it had so little mass. Go ahead.
Okay, you're very close to the answer. I would suggest finding something other than heat capacity as the magic key that turns the lock. But anyone else with any a suggestion? But you're as close as comes to the answer.
Then to we all voice.
That's Richie.
I would say no. And the reason I'm saying no, I've had the fire fall off my cigarette. And right away I get a burn. Maybe the temperature of the fire of tobacco at the end of the cigarette is higher, lower. I don't know. Maybe you know. But I would say no.
I mean, the way to look at it is at 300 degrees Fahrenheit, that's about 150 degrees centigrade. So that's water boiling. That's akin to kind of asking a person if they put their hand in boiling water, would it hurt? So the answer, obviously, in that case is yes. But I'm going for the more general picture of, is there any object that you could bring up to 300 degrees Fahrenheit and hold in your bare hands? And John was very, very close with the idea of aerogel having such little mass that it has very little specific heat in it. So, but it's not exactly what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, I've got a further explanation for a special condition. If you take the ceramic tiles that were on the space shuttle, they were a material with very low specific heat, very low mass, very fluffy-like material. The air hitting the space shuttle during reentry, let me drop it, could create heating of a couple of thousand degrees Fahrenheit, but because the characteristics of those tiles was such that it had an extremely low thermal conductivity and extremely low specific heat, so even though the outer layer was at a couple of thousand degrees Fahrenheit, the inner layer was almost not heated at all. If you had the surface of one of those tiles heated to 300 degrees Fahrenheit, and you put your hand on it, where your hand touched that material, the material would instantaneously come down to the temperature of your hand, and you could continue holding it. It wouldn't stay at that temperature while you're holding it, but it would cool off so fast because it has such a low thermal conductivity and such low specific heat. So I think you could grab that material. I believe I saw a demonstration of somebody doing that. They aimed a blowtorch at that material, took away the blowtorch, and the person put his hand on the material, and he didn't burn his hand. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
See, we watch the same YouTube. You like Veritasium as well. Derek Mueller is the guy that does Veritasium, and he's on an aerogel kick lately. And he did demonstrate a interesting layer. It's not actually made out of pure aerogel because aerogel is unfortunately a very brittle and hygroscopic material. So moisture ruins it. Too much mechanical action ruins it. You know, breathing on it too hard ruins it. This was apparently fiberglass that was impregnated with aerogel materials, something like a half inch worth, and they had some poor guy with a flamethrower on one end, and he was putting his hand on the material on the other side, and the other side wasn't too hot. It was a little above ambient room temperature, but not terribly hot. But in addition, in the same video, he had a segment where they had a material that also had a slight layer of iron oxide, which absorbs infrared. So the way that radiation, that heat gets transferred is through convection, conduction, and radiation. Convection and conduction doesn't really happen much with aerogel because there's so little of the silicon dioxide in it. Mostly it's empty space. The trick is to getting rid of the radiation because it can still radiate infrared, but with the iron oxide that absorbs that. So he was able to heat up a piece of material that had something like a millimeter of the insulating material on the surface and look at a thermal reading, and it read 150 degrees centigrade, which is 300 degrees Fahrenheit. And he was able to put his hand on it and pick it up and do anything. It's because the temperature will go into you, but it's the rate that the temperature and the amount that makes the difference. If it goes very slowly because the thermal conductivity is almost non-existent, then you can hold anything at any temperature. It's the material that's able to transfer its temperature to you where you get problems.
I think it was the exact same Veritasium or another one like it where Mr. Mueller had two chunks of material, the exact same physical size. One was, I'm guessing, a chunk of aluminum, and the other one was a chunk of wood or something like that. And he had people touch them and say, which one is hot and which one is cold? Everyone said the aluminum was cold and that the chunk of wood wasn't cold. He then held a thermometer on each of them, and they were the identical temperature. And he said, what is going on? And they had great trouble explaining what's going on. Your hand is at 90 degrees Fahrenheit, and when you put it against the aluminum, your hand gets cooled off immediately by the thermal conductivity of the aluminum. You put your hand at 90 degrees Fahrenheit on the chunk of wood, and the near surface of the wood immediately goes to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So your body says the aluminum is cold, and the wood is not cold. In reality, they're identical in temperature, and your senses are fooling you on that one. That was another experiment that he often shows you experiments where people get the wrong answer. He's convinced that that helps you understand not only human nature, but a little bit more of the physics of what's happening. You probably saw that one too, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW.
I did. I think he's very popular because of that. If he told you things you already knew, it wouldn't really go that far. It wouldn't entertain you. It wouldn't impress too many people. It's the counterintuitive things that he's able to demonstrate that I think that causes his incredible popularity. Also, he's a charming guy, so that doesn't hurt either. But it only goes to show one of the many things is your the temperature sensors in your fingertips are not thermocouples. They don't work like thermocouples. They trick you into giving you a sense of hot and cold, but they do it in a cut corner sort of way. And he demonstrated how one of those corners are cut, and that's why often you hear people talk about the coldness of metal. It's because metal is a highly thermally conductive material, whereas a lot of other things don't conduct temperature as well and isn't perceived as being cooler than metals are.
Right on. And to add one more step to what's going on here, when your 90-degree Fahrenheit skin of your hand touches that 70-degree Fahrenheit chunk of aluminum, the surface of your hand immediately goes to roughly 70 degrees Fahrenheit. When your 90-degree hand touches that chunk of wood, the near surface of the wood immediately goes to nearly 90 degrees. So the wood surface goes up to your hand temperature. Your hand goes down to the temperature of the aluminum because of that huge difference in thermal conductivity and specific heat of those materials. And therefore, the fact that your surface of your hand in one case is really changing its temperature and the other case it's not, your senses can really fool you on that one as to what is hot and what is cold. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
You are, Dick. And if we weren't warm-blooded creatures, eventually our hand and the wood would come to some equilibrium average between the two, dependent upon what specific heat and mass everything had. But since we're warm-blooded, we keep on burning fuel and we keep on heating things up to, you know, 98.6 in our core and a little bit lower out, you know, on the surface. So that experiment wouldn't be a closed system. It's fascinating to watch these things, and he is a fascinating guy, and I'm going to put up a link to that particular Veritasium, although I would recommend just about every Veritasium episode that I've seen him make. He's a clever guy, he's a smart guy, and he's a good performer and a good explainer, which is a good thing.
Yeah, I think he's making quite a few dollars off of those Veritasium videos. Somebody is financing his trips to go to all kinds of places in the world to make measurements. But there's one other thing I was going to mention to you. Oh, I can't think of it now. It'll come to me in a minute. Thank you, Roy, KGRIW. Oh, yes. There's a rule of thumb that was being used in the engineering department of the company I work for. The rule of thumb was that an ordinary human hand can hold on to an object of, I think it was either 150 or 160 degrees Fahrenheit. Let's make it 150. You can hold on to an object of 150 degrees Fahrenheit continuously if you're touching it very lightly. That's the limit of high temperature objects before you start developing grief and blisters or whatever, either 150 or 160 Fahrenheit, some number like that. Over to you, Roy, KQRIW.
I mean, there's one point where it causes cellular damage. There's another point where people's pain threshold is too high. I regularly, when I do my little espresso thing and I steam my milk, it's supposed to go up to about 150. I'm not going to touch that area that's 150. I hold the handle because for me, it's too hot. It probably wouldn't cause blisters. But it does cause a lot of discomfort, and that's a little bit different for each person. Some people tolerate a little bit more pain than other people.
There are people who really like their coffee hot. My wife is one of those. Really likes her coffee hot, and that bothers the daylights out of me, where I picture that hot fluid just barely being tolerated by her tongue and going down her esophagus, and I think that can do damage if that's done without enough skill. I think it can do damage to an esophagus, and you might not have enough pain sensing down there to know that you're doing damage. That's a guess on my part. Over to you, Roy.
I would agree. Overly hot coffee. I tend to like espresso and such, so I have a boiler that keeps the temperature at about 203 degrees Fahrenheit, which I don't find terribly hot. But there are people out there who just boil water, run it through grounds, and swallow the stuff, and they don't yelp in pain. But, yeah, it's going to cause irritations the same way that chronic, I don't want to compare the two, but chronic alcohol ingestion also produces esophageal irritations, and when you irritate something, when you are exposed to any kind of carcinogen, if you don't irritate something, you might get away with it. But if you start to irritate the surroundings and cause accelerated cell cycling, death and reproduction and death and such, you increase the risks of esophageal cancer. So it's not unusual in cigar smokers and alcohol imbibers to get head and neck cancers due to that.
Roy, what's your best guess as to the temperature that you take your espresso and put it into your mouth? What is the temperature of the fluid you put into your mouth when you're drinking your espresso? And I'm guessing you let your mouth cool it off a bit before you swallow it. Over to you, Roy.
The espresso starts out at around 203 degrees Fahrenheit. The steamed milk ends up at around 150, about 50-50 of both of them. And plus, usually it takes me a minute or two. So I would say roughly, I haven't stuck thermometers into it before I drank it, I would say about 160 degrees.
Okay, let's assume it is 160, and that's a fluid with very high thermal conductivity. I am guessing you hold it in your mouth for a while, and it gets cooled by your tongue quite a bit before it actually gets swallowed. I'd like to believe you would do I'm afraid you might do damage if you swallowed 160 degree Fahrenheit liquid. Over to you, Roy.
I mean, my favorite is cappuccino, which is a lot of foamed milk. So actually, it's the thermal conductivity is not terribly high for a cappuccino. So I haven't had any problem. I haven't burnt my tongue. Occasionally with Mr. Coffees, I have. But with my espresso, I haven't.
W.H. Roy Y, with a question related to somewhat what you're talking about.
Hey, Joe.
My question is, I've had this demonstrated to me, and it's kind of hard to accept sometimes, that heat travels at the same speed that light does, because you don't think of it like that, but I've had that demonstrated to me by being at a particular location where something goes off that's very bright and you feel the heat radiation from that same instant in time that you see the light. There's like no difference in timing. My question is, does light, heat, and radio waves behave the same way as far as losing the energy as you go out from the source of it with the inverse square law? Does it hold the same or does it not?
Okay. Unfortunately, the answer partially is going to be it's complicated. The way that temperatures are conducted from one object to another in a closed system is not only by radiation. By radiation, the rate of dissipation is the speed of light, because it's for the most part infrared or other spectrum of light shooting out from the source, being absorbed on the surface of whatever body is being equilibrated to that temperature, and that's why you say that heat travels at the speed of light. Radiative heat does. There's also conduction, which does not travel at the speed of light. That's individual atoms bouncing up and down against each other and passing kinetic energy. That takes longer than the speed of light. And then there's convection, which is the very chaotic flow of gases and fluids in general, which is slow, erratic, and there are areas where there isn't a great deal of mixture immediately. Over time, it balances out, but there's a much greater delay. So there's more than one mechanism for the transfer of temperature from one object to another, and they all manifest different modes and different speeds.
Okay, thank you.
And to we are, boy.
Yes, Richie.
Okay, talking about heat. I don't like very hot coffee. In fact, I drink only iced coffee, even in the winter. It's made on a coffee maker I usually buy a Colombian coffee, very good with ice. Soup, I only like it warm, not hot. That's the way I am. Have a question. Why is it that if it occasionally happens where the fire falls on the cigarette, it immediately gives me a blister? Do you know, or maybe somebody else knows, temperature of a lit cigarette? And why does it burn immediately, Roy? Back to you.
It pretty much goes back to what we said, the thermal mass and the thermal conductivity. Ash pretty much is you know, it's burning. It's produced by the heat of your combusting tobacco. So I don't know exactly at what temperature it burns, but I'm sure it's enough to give anyone a blister. And then you get a big wad of fresh, red-hot cinders on you, and that burns. So it's a combination of things, that the starting temperature that the ash is produced is rather hot, and it has good thermal conductivity to your skin.
Okay, boy, good enough. And by the way, a comment, not a medical question, but a comment. I was diagnosed recently, last week, by a cardiologist as having had a silent heart attack. That was confirmed with a echocardiogram, is that what they call it? So what I've been doing, and I found it helps other things, the French and the Italians are known to have lower than normal, compared to the rest of the world, heart disease. I drink now a little bit of wine each day and before I go to bed. I also found that, you know, I have Tourette syndrome. It calms it down. I do take Norvasc now, but I don't want to add another tranquilizer or anything like it. I find a natural thing, wine, helps me tremendously and hopefully will prevent me from having another heart attack.
Okay, Richie, good. I hope it works for you. The mechanism you're talking about, echocardiograms are a way of imaging the chambers of the heart. And the heart is basically a four-chambered ball of muscle, and it contracts along a certain rate due to conductive fibers running through it and such. If you take an echocardiogram of a heart and you see a portion of the heart that's just kind of sitting there and it's not contracting, it's usually because the muscle was replaced with scar tissue from a earlier heart attack. So that's probably what he saw, that you have areas of non-contraction of your heart muscle. As far as the French do have a slightly decreased risk of heart disease, I don't think it's as pronounced in the Italians, though. There is some suggestion that it is related to some of the material in wines, mostly red wines, but that's up for conjecture as well. Alcohol in moderation, I guess, is okay. You have to keep in mind that if you're taking a Klonopin along with it, that's a little bit of too much sedation sometimes, so be cautious.
Yes, I know, boy. Instead of a Klonopin, I drink the wine. I think that's a good trade-off. I don't really know, but that's what I'm doing. It also tends to moderate the movements of my Tourette's, which is also a great thing.
Well, Klonopin and alcohol and a bunch of other things are relaxants, and so they will do all of that to one degree or another. And I wish you luck, but I think you should inform your doctors of if you're self-medicating, because they really should share that information with you.
Oh, I know. I gotta go to my internist, which is not too far, Garden City. Cardiologist is in New Hyde Park. I have to see him back. He said 7 weeks.
Now, Rich, be careful now. You've been told many times not to discuss personal medical situations over this net. So I think you guys better stop this conversation and go on to the next subject. Back to you, Roy.
I'm sorry, Dick. I didn't mean to get personal. I was giving out general information. That's it. I'm done.
Yes, Sam, you have a question?
Yeah. I never ask questions, but you're talking about the heat and hot things. I have a good friend. He was in college. I think it was Duke. And you know they brand you the Omega sign on your arm. And he said he saw him heat up the iron. He could smell it burning. They blindfold him. And Roy, they put an ice cube on his arm, and you know it left a burn?
Sam, I mean, that goes back to the fact that our body cheats and cuts corners all over the place. Extreme hot and extreme cold pretty much feels about the same. It's only the suggestion of which end of the spectrum you're getting, whether or not you perceive it that way. So it's understandable that if you blindfold someone and tell them that they're going to be burnt and you give them something that's so cold that it gives them almost heat frost, that they'll feel that there's a burning thing going on. So again, it's just the way that nature kind of cut corners. It's good enough for the survival of the species, and it doesn't complicate the requirements for evolving things. So we find the simplest route, and we try and stick with that usually, biologically.
Yeah, it showed me the burn. Yeah, you're right. Everything you said is right. That's just funny, though, how the mind works, you know? Like mind over matter. The mind, the brain is really scary.
Yes, indeed, Sam. I agree with you completely. The mind is an incredible device. We have just scratched the very surface of it. And we still don't have a clue about most of what's going on. Every so often I try to show people either visual illusions or audio illusions that kind of demonstrate that our sensors aren't really telling us 100% accurately what's going on. Reality is not exactly what we perceive it to be. We're on a time delay. We're on a latency time delay of a couple of hundred milliseconds. And none of us know about it because our brain corrects for that and gives us the sense that we are experiencing our consciousness in real time with the world around us, which unfortunately we're not, but it works. You know, we survive. So thanks, Sam. Dick, it's coming up to 11 o'clock. I mean, I have another puzzle, but maybe it's best to just kind of hold off until next week.
Time.
Could always
complete.
Use the puzzle.
Well, let's ask Paul. Paul, you know how much material you would like to cover tonight, and so you make the decision, Paul, it's your time frame, so to speak, as to whether or not Roy should go to one more puzzle. WS2N, K2RW, you got the floor, Paul.
Oh, I would do one more puzzle. You know, I don't have all that much. We're in a slow period. I think the next launch is like at least 8 days away. So, and now with that hurricane down there, that's going to slow things down a bit, too. No problem. Back to you, Dick.
Very, very fine, Paul. Roy, you've got some interesting puzzle tonight. They've got people very active, so go right ahead. You're on a roll, Roy.
Hey, thanks a lot, Dick. Thanks a lot, Paul. This also calls for a little participation. There was this great question. I was talking to someone on the phone. They were watching Animal Planet, and apparently it came up on that episode of Animal Planet. And he asked me the question that I will ask you people. The question was, why do some turtles cry? Any ideas what that might be? Unfortunately, there's no yes or no answer. But think about it. Why do you think some turtles cry?
Cancer.
Yes, Rich.
Would it be a reaction to pain?